Alrighty, beautiful.
Okay,
good morning, everybody. We're back here for another daf in Yevamos. The Masechet is dedicated and sponsored by David and Paula Baumzer and Omo Construction.
Okay, we today's daf of Zion of Yevamos, and yet again, we are in the middle of this enormous sugya. This is, I think, not common. This is rare to find a sugya that goes on this way. It started on Gimel Amud Beis. The sugya that we're in the middle of begins with the question of the context, of course, is the same as it's always been. The Mishnah has the rule that you can't do Yibum in a situation where the woman that you'd be marrying is related to you and it would be an incestuous relationship. Despite the fact that every Yibum situation is ordinarily an incestuous relationship, because normally you're not allowed to marry the wife of your brother. So ordinarily that would be an incestuous relationship. The Torah, however, says in a situation of Yibum, when the brother dies without children, then that's the mitzvah of Yibum. So the question that the Mishnah dealt with is what happens if the woman who is your sister-in-law, and you're going to have a mitzvah of Yibum, what if she happens to be related to you through a second relationship that also would be an incestuous relationship? And that's where the Mishnah says that, well, in that case, you're not allowed to do Yibum. And the simplest example of that is, let's say, two brothers marrying two sisters, where and one of the brothers dies. So with respect to that man's wife, your brother's wife, the fact that she is the wife of your brother, that's one forbidden marriage. But the fact that she's also the sister of your wife, that creates a second incestuous relationship for a second reason. And in that case, that's where it says in the Mishnah that you're not allowed, there is no mitzvah of Yibum in that case. So that's the question. The question is that once the mitzvah of Yibum already applies in the case of forbidden marriage or one incestuous relationship, compounding it with another one, the Mishnah says that that blocks the mitzvah of Yibum, and the question is why? And that's where the Mishnah, that's where on Daf Gimel Amud Beis, right at the beginning, it asks, well, how do you know that's true? And there's a brisa on Gimel Amud Beis that says it's based on the pasuk by sister-in-law, meaning in that situation, it says you're not allowed to marry your wife's sister while your wife is alive, even if you're not married to her. And that the pasuk says, "Isha lachosa lo sikach litzror legalos ervasa aleha." So this word aleha is being used by the Tanaim to say that whatever the analysis is there, to say that you're not allowed to do yibum in this case. And it's then generalized to all of the other incestuous relationships that anytime any one of them is at play, you're not allowed to do Yibum. But the one exception, of course, being the obvious one, which is always present in a case of Yibum. So that is what happened on Gimel Amud Beis. And the Gemara asks this very simple question, which is, and if not for that pasuk, aleha, what would I have said? That's how this all starts. It all begins on that question. And this sugya keeps going all the way through our daf, and it'll end on next week. It'll end on next week's daf. So in the course of that discussion, and this is one of those where you really need to see the forest from the trees. There are beautiful trees all through all of these seven dafim or whatever it is, six dafim or so, but that you have to step back and be able to see what was going on at different points in the Gemara. We had begun by examining the question of the general principle of ase docha lo sase, and what's the basis for that principle, that when you have a conflict of mitzvos and you have a dilemma of obligation, which one wins, and you have a mitzvah sase compelling one action, and that puts you up against a lo ta'ase forbidding that action. So in general, the policy is ase docha lo sase. We spent a lot of time talking about the source for that principle. We never really had an unambiguous solution to that. And then we were wondering about the parameters of that issue and whether it will apply if the lo ta'ase is a high-level lo ta'ase with kares. that was really what activated all of this, because if it would apply in a Kari situation, and that's all the incestuous relationships will be like that, so then we would understand why I need the Pasuk Aleha to forbid Yibam, despite the fact that general rule of Asei Dochelos Asei. But if it would apply in Kari situations, so then I needed a Pasuk to block that. But if anyway Asei is not Dochelos Asei in Kari situations, and that's what you have in the incestuous case, so then we're back to the question, why did the Tana on Daf Gimel have to resort to a Pasuk Aleha in order to block Yibum in the situation, since anyway you had no permission to do the Yibum because of the high level ban of Kares that goes to the prohibition of incest? So that's the logic of what was driving much of what was going on in the past. So that's we pick up with this. We are working on the assumption that Asei will be docher lo sasei. In the middle of the Vav Amud Beis, the Gemara presented a brisa here, which says, what's the rule with respect to executing somebody convicted of some capital crime? The rule is that if somebody is convicted of a crime, you're supposed to carry out the sentence immediately. If somebody is convicted of a capital crime, you're supposed to execute immediately. That's the rule. What happens if the conviction happens like late on a Friday afternoon or whatever, and you would want to do the execution on Shabbos? So you're allowed to execute a criminal on Shabbos is the question. And we're being told over here in Vav Amud Beis, this was last week's daf, was that no, you're not allowed to execute criminals on Shabbos because the pasuk says you're not allowed to lo tevaru esh. You're not allowed to make fires. And you're not allowed to do any other malachos on Shabbos. And presumably, the pasuk says, even b'chol mashroseichem, that even means even in Beis. So that was what was going on last week. The question is whether, again, the fact that the Tana has a pasuk to block you from executing a criminal on Shabbos, even though Shabbos involves a high-level crime. So you see, what are you supposed to infer from that? Are you supposed to infer from that ordinarily, if not for the pasuk, I would say that the imperative, the mitzvah to execute criminals, would justify violating Shabbos also, and that you say asei, mitzvah asei, has to be followed, even if it involves doing a lot asei with kares. And if that's true, then we're back to the original question about yibum. That was what happened last time. And so that brings us to the bottom. Three lines from the bottom. Amar Rav Simi Barashi. Rav Simi Barashi says the following. He says, no, you don't understand. Let's go with the principle is that mitzvah saseh cannot be docha lo ta'aseh sheish bo kares. Let's assume a mitzvah saseh cannot be performed if it would put you in violation of a high-level crime of kares. If that's the case, so then anyway I would have had no permission to execute the criminal on Shabbos. And so why did I need a pasuk? So Rav Simi Barashi says, no, there's a different principle operating here. It's not based on asei docha lo ta'aseh, and therefore you can't infer anything about, generally speaking, asei docha lo ta'aseh, and therefore drop the entire analysis. But instead, let's just focus specifically on the issue of executing criminals. So Amar Rav Simi Barashi, hai tana, lo mishum di'asti asei v'dachi lo ta'aseh. The Tana who had the pasuk of lo tevaru eish, which means don't execute criminals on Shabbos, is not addressing the argument of asei docha lo ta'aseh. Ela mishum demaisi me kal v'chomer. He says no, because you would have had another reason why you would have argued that you have to execute criminals even on Shabbos. Namely, what is it? Kal v'chomer. What's the Kal V'chomer? Kal V'chomer just means it's a logical analysis from comparing two considerations which fall along a continuum. Anyway, it's obvious when you get used to Kal V'chomer is what they are. The Hachi Ko'amar. And this is the Kal V'chomer. It goes as follows. Now remember, there was a Bryson. The Bryson itself up above said, are you supposed to execute criminals on Shabbos? After all, on the one hand, it says you're not allowed to break Shabbos. On the other hand, it says you have to put criminals to death. And so, okay, that's how it goes up above. So we're going to kind of, our Gemara down at the bottom has the Amora of Simi Barashi. He picks up from that line in the Braisa, and then he goes with it. And so here's what it says. That's what the Heiko stands for. When the Torah forbids you from violating Shabbos, maybe that does not apply to executing criminals. What's me Mises based in? If I'm Mises based in Dachi Shabbos, maybe when it comes to executing criminals, maybe you have to do that even on Shabbos. May Kal V'chomer. Because I have a Kal V'chomer. What's the Kal V'chomer? Now I'm on our Daf finally. Daf Zayin Amud Aleph. Ma Avoda Sheichamura V'docha Shabbos. So here's the way it goes. We step back and we say, well, what kinds of things can you do on Shabbos that appear to be violations of Shabbos? One of them is the service of the Karbanot in the Beit HaMikdash. So ma avoda means Karbanos in the Beit HaMikdash. You have to offer the Shabbos Karbanos, which normally involves Shabbos violations, but the Chumash prescribes doing them on Shabbos. So we know that the Torah obviously holds certain avodos Karbanos to trump Shabbos, to supersede Shabbos, to take precedence over Shabbos. Ma avoda shi chamura. So we know avoda is very chamur, v'docha Shabbos, and the Torah wants you to do it even on Shabbos. Ritzicha docha osa. And this usage of the word ritzicha is funny. Normally we're used to the word lo tertzach, don't kill. Ritzicha is in murder, unjustified murder, but we're using that to refer to based in executing criminals. So it means, but nevertheless, carrying out the death penalty, docha osa. We know that the death penalty, executing criminals, will supersede even avodata karbanot. Shenamar, like it says in the pasuk, me'im izbechi tikachenu lamus. The pasuk says, if somebody is guilty, is convicted of a crime, a capital crime, me'im izbechi tikachenu lamus. You take the guy to death, even if you have to pull him away from the Mizbeach. So the image there is that you have a Kohen who you need, you're depending upon the Kohen to do Avodat HaKorbanot, and even if he's the last Kohen available, we'll pull him away from the Beis HaMikdash in order to execute him, and even if that means that you're not going to have anybody available to do the Korbanot that time. So what you see is that the imperative to execute criminals is even takes precedence over Avodat HaKorbanot, and Avodat HaKorbanot, we just said, takes precedence over Shabbos. So if A is greater than B and B is greater than C, then clearly A is greater than C. That's the analysis that would have led us to say that you would have had to execute criminals on Shabbos. And that's why you needed to be told a pasuk in the previous daf that says, well, you can't, because the Chumash says, Lo Sevaru Eish, V'chol Moshroseichem, on Shabbos you're not allowed to. So our Gemara continues. It says, "Eino din, isn't it obvious shetehei ritzicha docha osa, that executing the criminal should even take precedence over Shabbos?" And that sounds like a pretty strong argument. However, if you remember the Braisa presented it, it said, like on second thought, maybe it's the other way around. That's the way, if you remember the Braisa kind of was ambivalent. So it said on second thought, maybe it's the other way around. So if this is the argument now presented on top of Zayin HaMed Aleph for why you would argue that you do execute criminals on Shabbos, then what's the counter argument to have a second thought about? My o'eino de ko'amar. So then what was the second thoughts on this? Achi ko'amar. No, it's because here, there might be a refutation of this argument. Namely what? No, because there might be something wrong with the analysis. Namely what? Namely, I could have a yochiach. A yochiach means I can't exactly punch holes in the argument. The argument sounds pretty strong, but all I know is that clearly the argument is invalid because it leads me to a false or absurd conclusion if I apply the argument elsewhere. So that's called a yochiach. So in our case, we say like this, well, if that argument was strong, then it would follow that burying a mate mitzvah means somebody, you find a body and you don't have relatives taking care of the body, or suddenly, automatically, that transforms the obligation of kavura to a different type of mitzvah. It's a mitzvah of burying a mate mitzvah. It's a different level of kavod ames. And there are certain kinds of rules that apply. In this case, we're going to see one of them right now. let's see how this goes. Our Gemara is assuming that you're familiar with all kinds of other stuff. We're going to try to fill in those gaps here. And here's what it says. Gevuras meis mitzvah, if you find the meis mitzvah, meaning you find the body and you need to bury the meis right there, tochiach, that shows there's something wrong with your calculation. Namely what? Because shadoches avoda, because that the obligation to bury the meis mitzvah, to take care of the meis mitzvah, is a strong obligation that would even take precedence over avoda, over korbanos, vein doches Shabbos. But we're not going to let you do this on Shabbos, to bury the meis on Shabbos. So that's a counter argument. Now, and then we just explain it again. So here we go over it again. Hadar amar like this. Well, okay, no, stop. So what were the principles being used over here? So here's how it goes. There is a Gemara elsewhere that says that if I am on my way to bring Korban Pesach to do Avodas HaKorbanos, that's being used as an example of Korbanos, I have to bring Korban Pesach. And on my way there, I find a body lying there on the ground and unattended, and I can't figure out, you know, who I have to call to take care of it. So I become personally obligated to handle the burial, and I'm going to have to forego Korban Pesach because that's going to make me tamei. I'm not going to be able to bring the korban, and therefore, you see, this is what we're saying right now: is you see that the obligation to bury a meis mitzvah is docha avoda. So that sets up one leg of this analysis. And then we've already said before that avoda is docha Shabbos, so it should follow. That I should say that burying the meis mitzvah should be allowed on Shabbos. And there is no actual source that says it's not allowed. We're just assuming that it's obvious that you're not allowed to bury the meis mitzvah on Shabbos. We're going to question that in a minute. And so you see like this. This is what you see. If we're going to go with the argument that anything that beats korbanot, which beats Shabbos, therefore that thing would be allowed to be done on Shabbos, that must fail, which is the argument for executing criminals. So that must fail, because if you apply that all over the place, you'll apply that to meis mitzvah, burying a meis mitzvah, which you don't. And therefore, since you don't, it must mean that there's something wrong with the calculation. We don't know what's wrong, but the point is that something is wrong with the calculation. That's called the yochiyach. So now the Gemara here says, well, I don't know. How do you know that it's true that you don't bury meis on, that you don't allow or require burying the meis mitzvah on Shabbos? Hadar amar, kevuras meis mitzvah tidches Shabbos. Mikal v'chomer. Maybe you do have to bury the meis mitzvah even on Shabbos. Mikal v'chomer. What's the kal v'chomer? Same as we said. Ma'avoda shidocha Shabbos. Just like, what do you know about avodas ha-korbanos? That beats Shabbos. Whereas meis mitzvah docha usa, and burying the meis mitzvah beats korbanos, like we said about the Korban Pesach case. Me'vila achuso. That's the pasuk that the Gemara uses elsewhere to teach me this rule. Shabbos shenidcha mipnei avoda, in addition to kvoras meis mitzvah docha usa. So then it would follow that I do have to bury the mitzvah on Shabbos. Anyway, all of that is all going to the argument that I should execute criminals on Shabbos. So Talmud Lomar, Lo Savaru. That's why all of this together is why I needed a pasuk Lo Savaru. Point being that I would have needed a pasuk to stop me from executing criminals on Shabbos, not based on a consideration of Asei Docha Lo Asei, but based on this analysis, which means that with respect to our bigger issue of the parameters of Asei being Docha Lo Asei, we have no information simply from this Braisa about executing criminals on Shabbos. We thought that we would be able to infer something relevant from there, but now we're being told you can't, because the whole executing criminals on Shabbos, which you're not allowed to do, but that doesn't tell me anything about the general principles of Asei Docha Lo Asei, because that whole issue of executing criminals is going to be based more on this Kal V'Chomer analysis, not so much based on Asei Docha Lo Asei analysis. So we're really back where we started. So now the Gemara asks the following. Ulamai the salak adatei me'ikara da'asi Asei V'Dachi Lo Asei. If we're actually, but back before Rav Simi Barashi came along and said there's another operating principle that's going to encourage us to execute the criminal, and we thought that we were going to have to execute the criminal on Shabbos based on Asei Docha Lo Asei, once we were at that stage in our thinking process up above on Vav Amud Beis, what was the counter argument? L'mayde salaka da'ite me'ikar di'asi Asei V'dachi Lo Asei, when we were actually thinking that asay doche would be doche lo taasei. My o'ein of dekamar. What was the second thought that he had at that time? Remember, I said that the Braisa presented this as, well, maybe I would use asay doche lo taasei, but on second thought, maybe not. What was the on second thought that the Tana was thinking at that time? So our Gemara right now is yet again, this is like our 37th kind of a distraction and sidetracking that we're going into a small analysis of a local issue. It's not going to really get us anywhere, lead to anything, but it's just wondering what was the Tana thinking by second guessing the argument of asay doche lo taasei to execute the criminal on Shabbos. We go back and we rehash the same line. What do I do about the mitzvah of keeping Shabbos? Maybe that doesn't apply to executing criminals. But now the second thought is, well, Hadar Amar, Amar the Armin and Asiya Sevadachi Lotasei, Lotasei Greda. Well, maybe I don't have the right to say asay dochalot asay when there's kares. Okay, that was obviously the issue all along, is the say asay dochalot asay when there is kares. And now, Hadar Amar, like this. Look, every essay, this is such a fascinating line, these next two lines over here. If I ask you, before we learn the sugya, if I ask you to consider on your own the dilemma of a mitzvah asay versus a mitzvah lo taasei. Do you consider the obligation to perform mitzvot asays? That's something that the Chumash wants you to do. There are no penalties or consequences to fail, but on the other hand, that's what the Torah wants. On the other hand, something where the Torah forbids you from acting in a certain way and it carries consequences and penalties. There might be malkos, and there might not be malkos, and it might be no penalties, but it might be. When you're facing that dilemma, normally, what would your instincts tell you? I think that your instincts would say that the Torah's ban against acting inappropriately, which is lo taseh's prohibitions, are a higher priority. And therefore, if you're required to act a certain way, you have to do a certain mitzvah, but you can't do a certain mitzvah if it's going to put you up against a lo taseh in a veira. Yet that's not the rule. The rule is asay doche lo taasei. So you see that the obligation of keeping the mitzvah asay is apparently what the Torah wants, even when you're in violation of something which seems to be a greater crime than what you gained by doing the mitzvah. So now the Gemara goes like this. He says, okay, so once I'm prepared to anyway do regular lo taaseis, adram otu asay doche lo taasei. Once anyway, the mitzvah taseh is being docha the lo taseh, lav lo taseh chamer mine, isn't the lo taseh anyway more serious a consequence than the failure to do the mitzvah taseh? And nevertheless, we're doing the assay. The ka'asi assay, v'dachi lei, and nevertheless, the Torah wants the assay to be docha the lo taseh. So then, mali chumra zuta, mali chumra rabba. So then why would I think that it should matter if the punishment for the crime that I have to do in the service of the mitzvah asay is a punishment that carries kares? I mean, I already was anyway unable to use my instincts here, and I had to do the mitzvah asay, even though it meant that I was doing a crime in the service of that mitzvah asay. So that's where the Gemara over here is saying, I still have to follow asay, do chelot asay, and presumably that should apply even in kari situations. So rather than saying, well, when there's kares, presumably I have no authority to perform the mitzvah asay. No, I say the reverse. I say, well, anyway, I wouldn't have had any reason to perform any mitzvah asay when it's a lota asay involved. So why should the strength of the lota asay matter? Anyway, so that's where we're up to in the... That's why earlier on, the Tana felt a little bit unsure. He had good, strong arguments on both sides of the analysis, and that's why he needed a pasuk to resolve. That's why Talmud Lomar, lo tevaru. So now we get to the point that says as follows. We're actually at a point where we can kind of step back about five levels up in our original question, and we can say, So really, let's figure out. So what is Eleha, the pasuk about Yibum? What really are we supposed to make of that? What would we have been saying on our own if not for the Gzeres HaKasav of Eleha? So here's what it's saying. It's saying, so now actually once we come to realize that we could see all of the arguments in all different directions, so we're not entirely sure where we stand. So what would we say about the Yibum situation when it involves a second incestuous crime? So here's what it says. Maybe it's not going to be based on a Seidocha Lo Ta'ase at all. There's going to be maybe a whole other argument for why we should, or maybe shouldn't, perform the mitzvah of Yibum in the case of the other, of the Yibum situation where it involves a second incestuous relationship. Let's see. Ella, I like this. This Ella carries us really far back, this Ella. It's the Rif. You know why I need the Pasuk Aleha? We're back to the original question. This should sound very familiar to anybody who says Rabbi Shmuel Omer in the beginning of the davening. We encounter a long list of drasha methods, a drasha techniques that we're familiar with Kal v'chomer. That one we saw on this page. We didn't see Gzeir Shava on this page. But the rest of them we rarely encounter. I would have to say we would never encounter. Except here on our page, we encounter a few of them. So it's interesting. Our daf actually talks us through a number of these exotic drasha methods. Now remember, drashos are the work of Tanayim. The Tanayim are making drashos on halachos and developing the halachos. The Amorayim are not generally doing drashos. Once in a long, long while, you'll find an Amora has a drasha, and it's very possible that the Amora, because it's so rare, probably that wasn't really, he wasn't innovating the drasha, he was just reporting the drasha. And once in a while, you get somebody who's an Amora who actually says, I make this drasha, and that's very rare. But usually you'll find drashos who are the domain of the Tanoim. And so what Amoraim are doing is they are trying to understand the drashos and apply the halachos. So here on our page, we're seeing the Amoraim proposing certain drashos might have been the thinking of the Tanoim. And you'll see that they're not that comfortable with these drashos. So let's see. So it says here like this. One of the mitos of the drashos that we rarely encounter, but that it listed there in Rabbi Shmuel Omer, is this one. You have a class of elements. The davar is one of the elements. Shahaya bichlal was part of a set. The yatsam in a klal lilamed, and the chumash excludes this element from that set, and it gives it some unusual property. Lilamed, teaching me this property about this element. Lo lilamed ala tzmo yatsa, ela lilamed ala kalkulo yatsa. The way you're supposed to understand the halacha is that whatever that property was that applied to that one element is supposed to be applied to the entire set. Let's see how that goes. This, Anya. Davar shahaya bichlal. Okay, there's a brisa that says the following. If I have some element in the chumash, some item, whatever that the chumash is referring to, shahaya bechlal, which was included in a general class, the yatsam in a klal, and the Torah excluded it to teach me some particular rule, vechule. And it doesn't even bother finishing the sentence because it just said it above, and we're all familiar with it from Rabbi Shmuel Omer. Okay, Tzad, what's an example of this? It goes like this. Anafesh esher tochal basar, mizavach hashlamim, v'tumah sova lav. Pasuk says that if I have a person who's tameh and he eats kachim, and particularly the kachim that's identified here is the basar of the korban shlamim. Here is what it says. If a person who's tameh eats some meat of a korban shlamim, and it says that he gets karis, that's what it says in Pasuk. So here's the problem. The problem is, v'halo shlamim bichlal kachim hayu. We already knew this rule because Shlamim actually was a member of the broader class of all kachims, of all hektesh. And we know about Hekdesh, the Chumash says the same thing. Rashi fills in. There's a pasuk that says about Hekdesh that all anybody who eats any Hekdesh is Chayiv Kares. So why does the Chumash have to spell that out specifically with respect to Shlamim here? Lahakish alihen velomer lach mashlamim meyuchadim kachim is beyach afkol kachim is beyach. It tells me the rule that I'm supposed to learn the halacha of kares to shlamim applies not just to shlamim but to anything that's in the shlamim class. Now, what class is that? So really, it's part of two classes. One class called all kachim is beyach, which means all karbanos. And then that itself is a subset of an even broader class called hekdesh generally, anything with kedusha. All hekdesh objects can be divided into several types. So one type is called kachim is beyach. Kachim is beyach means karbanos that are associated with karbanos. With hekdesh associated with karbanos. But then there's a whole other type of hekdesh, which is just general property belonging to the Beis HaMikdash. That has nothing to do with karbanos necessarily. These are things like if you pledge money to the Beis HaMikdash, you give money to hekdesh, or your machatzah shekel stuff, or anything that you hand over to hekdesh, hekdesh becomes the owner of the object. It's hekdesh stuff. But at the same time, it's not associated with karbanos specifically. Only the karbanos are associated with karbanos. And so what happens? Imagine the following. Let's say I had some hekdesh, owned some animals that I had not intended to use for karbanos, or just using, somebody had just pledged these things to hekdesh, and hekdesh was planning on auctioning these off to somebody who needed karbanos and was going to make money from it and then use the money to pay for services that it needed for the upkeep of the mikdash, whatever. And so somebody came along and was not allowed to, but killed and ate some of that meat and was tameh. So you're going to say that the person, although was guilty of me'ila, which does not carry kares, but are you going to say that this person was guilty of the crime of tameh she'achal hekdesh? So we're being told over here, you don't say that. You don't say that. It's only the class of kachay mizbeach, which is the class of the shlamims, that have this rule of kares. In any case, that's a very subtle halacha that's being derived from this principle of davar shehayu bechlal v'yatzah min haklal lamed, lo lamed al atzmo yatzah, ela lamed al kol kulo yatzah, which means if the member of the class is singled out for a certain halacha, it's intended to apply to the entire class. In our case, it was being used for something to tell me the rule of an even broader class to exclude the small class from the broad class. Okay, exactly why this should work out, I don't know, but that's the way the Gemara here is presenting it to us. So now let's see why that applies to the Yibam situation. So it goes like this. Hachanami, ha'eshes ach, bechlal kol ho'arayas haisa. Every time you have two brothers, and one dies, the wife of the dead brother is the sister-in-law of the Yavam. So the sister-in-law of the Yavam is already included in the list of incestuous relationships or forbidden marriages. Bilama yatsasa. And clearly the Torah singled it out as being subject to the mitzvah of Yibam. L'hakishe leha v'lomer lach ma'isha eshe sach sharia af kol arayas nami sharia. So presumably that's to tell me that all of the arayos are the subject to the same exemption of Yibum. Namely what? Namely, just as sister-in-law is a prohibited relationship that's overridden by Yibum, so too I would have said that all the other incestuous relationships would be overridden in the case of Yibum. The Gemara says, what kind of baloney is that? That is not how you use this principle. Me dummy? There's no comparison to using that principle for this case of Yibam to the way it was originally intended. Midami, hasam kolo be'isur uparat be'isur. No, the way this drasha works is, it's kind of humorous, but we're being told over here that the Amoraim are kind of arguing about how do you apply this principle? Because they themselves aren't applying this principle. They're just talking on behalf of like what they're trying to kind of guess what the thinking process of the Tanaim was. So they're saying, well, look, the way this drasha works is that if the Torah gives you a general rule and then the Torah reiterates the rule for a member of the class, so that's when it activates this whole rule, not when it tells you that one of these is an exception. It says, "Hasam kol al be'isur apart be'isur," but hafa kol al be'isur apart be'etzer. But in the case of the forbidden marriages in the Yiva situation, the broad rule is that it's forbidden. And over here, in the case of the sister-in-law, it's permissible and it's a mitzvah of Yibam. So you can't use the principle to then say, well, I guess all the other members of the class are also permissible in the case of Yibam. No, that's the point of the exception. So you don't know where you stand, and therefore this is no good, and that was not a good basis. So we're back to our question of, why the Chumash have to say Aleha in the first place to forbid Yibam in a case of a second incestuous relationship? Then the Gemara says, "Halo dami, halo dami." So it says, you know what this is more like? There is another drasha that we also read in Rabbi Shmuel Omer that actually will be applicable to our case of Yibam, and of course it goes against our purposes. "Halo dami, halo ledavar shahaya bichlal v'yasali don bedavar echadash she'iyata yachal lachzira lechlalo ad she'yachzen rakosiv lechlalo befeirush." That's what we say in Rabbi Shmuel Omer. That's what being told over here should be the principle that governs the case of Yibam and the other forbidden relationships. What does this principle tell me? It says like this. Let's say the Chumash gives you a general rule and one element is singled out for some special treatment. So this rule tells me that once that exceptional member of the class is singled out for some exceptional principle, exceptional rule, the reality is now I can't even apply the regular rules to this exceptional case. It has to be treated as totally unique. She'in ata yachal lahachzira lechlalo. You can't even treat it as a member of the original class at all. Ad she'achzen akosv lechlalo befeirush, unless the Chumash itself regroups it together with the class. This anya, let's see how this is used. Davar shahaya bechlal v'yatzali dan v'davar achadash. What's an example of this phenomenon? Here's what it says. So this is referring to the asham, the korban asham. And it says that when you bring in a korban asham, you have to shech the asham. In the same place where you would shech the chatas and the ola, namely in the tzafon. Ki kachatas ha'ashem hu lakoein, because the asham is like a chatas. So that's a funny phrase. What does that mean, the chatas is like an asham? We've already just said that it's treated like the asham. So what did we need to do that for? So here's why. She'ein talmud lomer kachatas ha'ashem. Ma talmud lomer kachatas ha'ashem. Why did the Chumash have to do it? Why the Chumash have to put the asham back with chatases? Because you know why? Because lefisha yatsa asham etzora lidon medavra chadash. Because one of the ashams, there are six ashams. One of the ashams is called asham mitzora. We're going to see on the Amud Beis a little more about the mitzora case. We've already had some exposure to mitzorayim all along here and there. But so never get it again. One of the steps in the process of Taras HaMetzora is that he has to bring his korbanos. So there's a whole set of korbanos that he has to bring. He has to bring an asham and a chatas and ola. So the rule is that the asham mitzora has to have, unlike regular korbanos, where the blood of the korban has sprinkled on the mizbeach, and only on the mizbeach, the asham mitzora has to be sprinkled on the body of the mitzora in a couple of places, in a few places, in his ear, and his thumb, and his toe. So it says here, lefisha yatza asham mitzora lidon bedavra chadash bebohen yad ubohen regel hayamanis. Once we're already having a separate, there's a kind of a uniqueness of the asham mitzora that the Torah excludes the asham mitzor from the regular ashams and the regular korbanos generally, that they have normal zrikas adam, but not the asham mitzora. So once it's treated as a unique member of the class, maybe it has to be excluded entirely from the class, and maybe I don't have to do any of the Zrikas Adam and Mizbeach at all, and that it doesn't have anything in common with regular Ashams. After all, it's unique. So Talmud Lomar, Anaman Amad Beis, Zayin Amad Beis, top line, and Talmud Lomar, that's why the Chumash had to replace Asham back with Chatas, to tell me when all other matters, it's the same. Ki kachatas ha-Asham, machatas tu'una matan damim u'erim l'gami mizbeach, af Asham to'an matan damim u'erim l'gami mizbeach. To put that's why the Chumash had to kind of reiterate, kachatas ha-Asham, the Asham has the same status as Chatas. In what particular way? In all other ways. Namely, that you need to treat the korban like a regular korban. You do zrikas adam, you put the blood on the mizbeach, and you burn the chelo on the mizbeach, etc. So that all of that is all playing out the argument called davar shehaya bichlal, and a member of a class, sheyatza lidon medavar achadash, that has an exceptional or an unusual halachic anomaly, sheyata yachol, so now maybe you can't treat it as a member of the class at all, unless the Chumash actually does explicitly replace it in the class, which is what it does for the Asham Mitzora. If that's the case, so now the Iloa Hadrei Kra have a And if the Torah had not replaced the member, the exceptional member back in the original class, I would have said that it's entirely distinct. So Achanami. So now that's actually how I would have looked at the case of the sister-in-law for Yibam situations. And how would I look at it? Like this. Havamina Eshesach, the Ishtarya. Havamina Eshesach, the Ishtarya, Ishtarai. I would have said like this. That normally the sister-in-law is one of the whole class of all forbidden marriages. And I would have said, well, now the Chumash excludes it from the class to tell me that I have to do Yibam. So I would have said, so it's unique. So I can't learn anything about regular Arayas from it because its example can't be generalized because it's unique. Shara Arayas, lo. Okay, where are we right now? So here's where we are. We just deflected the possible argument of using davar shehaya bichlal, the yatsam and a klal lamed. It's supposed to be used as a precedent for the entire klal. Wrong. It's the reverse argument that if it's an exceptional case, you can't infer anything about the general rule from it. That's what we're seeing over here. And therefore, we're back to saying that we aren't really sure of our grounds, where we would stand with respect to the other arayos. And we're back to wondering, why would we need the Pasuk Aleha to block Yibam in cases of a second incestuous relationship in that Yibam situation? Meaning, nobody's arguing on the fact that the Halacha does not permit it. You're not allowed to do Yibam. If, let's say, in the simple case of two brothers marrying two sisters, and one dies, the other brother cannot do Yibam with the widow. Because of the other ban of marrying the sister of your wife while your wife is alive. And so that is based on a Pasuk Aleha, and we're still wondering why it was necessary to have a Pasuk Aleha, and we're seeing over here, well, we're not entirely sure exactly yet why that would be the case. One possibility is because there's Kares involved, and that's why I would not have allowed it. But no, because maybe that's not an argument. So we're not entirely sure where we stand. Is it based on some other principle of a drush or anything? Well, not necessarily. So we're still not entirely sure. So here we get somewhere a little bit, at least for now. So let's see. Well, actually, at this point, the Gemara does the same kind of thing. It gives us a little bit of a dead end, but at least it's one that really ought to have been asked all the way back on Daf Gimel Amud Beis. It really was the very first question to be asked in the entire sugya. It goes like this. Ela salka data chamina teisi b'mamatzinu. Maybe it goes like this. Maybe I should use a principle called mamatzinu, which is pretty much the same as binyanav. We also use that in the Rabbi Shmuel Omer, the binyanav case, which is, whenever the Chumash tells me the rule in a certain case, the expectation is that I'm supposed to generalize that rule to the entire class. That's a basic principle of drashas. It's called binyanav, also called mamatzinu. It was like this. Mamatzinu me'eshes af, ma'eshes af, miyabma af achos isha tis yabein. If I know that the rule is that my brother's wife, which is a member of the class of forbidden incestuous relationships, the Torah tells me that I do yibum, so I'm supposed to presumably generalize that to all of the case of the forbidden incestuous relationships, I should be doing yibum if that comes up. Afachos isha, tis yabein. Even if that means the marrying, doing yibum with the sister of my wife. In other words, that's the basic drasha that we would have used to generalize the rule of doing yibum for all the other arayos, which we know is false, but the point is that that is where we would have started the discussion. Now the Gemara says, no. There's a reason why we didn't even ask this question. This question is too easily answered. Midami, pasam chad isura, pachatre isure. No, not so fast. That is when you're only up against one isur. You're only being put up against one pasuk, one crime. In other words, one incestuous relationship. But in the case of, let's say, two brothers marrying two sisters, tre isure, you're guilty of violating the double crime of sister-in-law from your brother and sister-in-law from your wife. So that's why that you wouldn't even have even thought seriously that you should use the mamatzina or the binyanav principle. And the Gemara says, not so fast. Wait a minute. Mahu disema. Wait a minute. Now we actually have a pretty serious argument coming up here. Mahu disema. Hoel v'ishtari ishtari. Not so fast. Let's think about this for a minute. Maybe the rule ought to be, and this is, again, you have to try to imagine that you're a Tana who's trying to figure out what would the rules be if you didn't have guidance. So it says here, well, maybe I should apply a principle called Hoyel the Ishtari, since the Torah permits it, Ishtari. It permits it in all cases. I'm going to have to see what the parameters of this rule are, or at least some of them. But the point being here is that, well, maybe like this. Hoil v'ishtari, since the Torah permits yibum in one instance of the arayos, and I'm already in violation of the iser erva, and I'm already in violation of incest. So maybe the fact that the Torah considers yibum overriding it, maybe it smooths the way, regardless of other instances of the same type of crime. Okay, well, that's very subtle. It's a subtle kind of an argument. It seems very similar to all the other arguments that we've been saying all along, but let's just see at least one instance of this, so we can at least see how comparable Yibum is to that one. Where do you get the idea that there is such a principle called Hoel v'ishtari ishtari? The word ishtari is the word shari. Shari is mutar in Aramaic. So ho'il, the ishtari, ishtari. Where do you see such a precedent for that principle? The sanya? Well, because we have it in the following braisa. Now, in order to get the following braisa, here's what's going on. We know that in the process of the mitzora becoming tahor, a mitzora is tame, a very intense tuma, and gradually becomes tahor again once the spots go away or once the colors fade. And so the rules are like this. While the mitzora is fully, experiencing the symptoms as a full level of tuma, and the mitzora has the highest level of tuma that exists. He's a source of tuma, and he even generates tuma even by association, without contact, in an ohel, and so he's a high-level tamei. Then, when the spots fade and goes away, so then the first thing that happens after the Kohen pronounces him tahor is that he has to bring his the birds, the korban of the birds, and he gets kind of sprinkled with the mayim chaim, with the water and the birds and the blood. And then a week later, goes to mikvah, and shaves all of his hair, goes to mikveh, and so at that point, he becomes only mildly tamei. And then he requires harav shemesh, just like many tameim require harav shemesh, which means they have to wait until nighttime, and then at the end of the night, then he becomes even less tamei. Right? So it becomes first a tevul yom, and then at the end of the day, he becomes almost entirely tahor. The only thing remaining is that he needs his karbanos the next day. He needs his karbanos, the asham and the chatas and all. He needs at least one of the karbanos to become fully tahor. Now, until he brings his karban, while he doesn't have any tuma, he has a residual prohibition against participating in any matters of Beis HaMikdash, of Hekdesh, of Kachim, of karbanos, of going into the Mikdash. He's what's called in Hebrew a mechusar kippurim. He's still lacking his karbanos. There are only four people who have such a requirement that after they become tahor from their tuma, they have to bring karban to become fully back to normal. And Mitzora is one of them. And so it says here like this. Imagine the following case. You have a Mitzora who underwent this tahara process and he shaved and everything on 2 days before Pesach. He's got to get close. And the day before Pesach, on Erev Pesach, he's ready to bring his korbanos. That's what he's planning on doing. That's the Shmini Shelo on Erev Pesach. But what happens to him? And the expectation is that ordinarily, he would have no problems. He would go to the Beis HaMikdash, and he would bring his korbanos, Chatas Ola Asham, and also he would bring his korban Pesach. And so he would first have himself, fully finished with his korbanos. He would have the blood on his thumbs and on his toes, whatever, these kind of things. And then he would be able to bring his korban Pesach, and he would be perfectly fine bringing his korban Pesach and eating it at night. Here's the problem. What happens to this poor guy? The ra keri bo biyom. But what happened was he became a balkeri. That means he emitted some semen, and for whatever the reason or incentive was, he ejaculated some zera. Now that has the effect, the Chumash describes, that has the effect of making the person tame. It's a very small tuma that requires just going to mikveh, and then that's pretty much it. You just have wait until the evening. So that's what happened to this Mitzora on the eighth day, on Erev Pesach. So how does that affect things here? Well, what that affects is that it just means that he's not going to be permitted. He's going to have to go to mikveh. Vitava, he went to mikveh. So now he has to wait until the evening in order to be allowed to go into the mikdash or even into Har HaBayis. So now he's not going to be able to bring his korbanos. He's not going to be able to participate in korban Pesach. Everything just went wrong because of that last event. So Amru Chachamim, afal pi she'ein tevul yom acher nechnas. So Chachamim say the following. Even though ordinarily a person who's a tevul yom, which means somebody who was a tamei like this balkeri, who went to mikveh like this guy did, but has to wait for the end of the day, normally you can't go into the mikdash under those conditions. But ze nichnas. But we're going to let this guy go in. Mutaf sheyavo asay sheish bokares v'yidcha asay shein bokares. On the one hand, the Gemara says that it's based on a weighing of pros and cons, and it's saying that the importance of bringing korban Pesach, which is asay sheish bokares, because if you don't bring korban Pesach for no good reason, then that incurs the penalty of kares. So that's a high level imperative. To bring korban Pesach. So what's standing in your way? What's standing in your way is that you're not allowed to go into the mikdash if you're at tevul yom. It's being treated as a mitzvah asay of Parshas Nasu. It says, Vishalchu min hamachane kol tzarua v'chol zav. You have to send away anybody who's a zav from the mikdash. Vishalchu min hamachane kol tzarua v'chol zav. So that's in the way. So it says here, well, given the one versus the other, I'd say that let the guy go into the mikdash to bring his korban, even though it means that he's guilty of being a tzvul yom in the mikdash. Okay, so now we have a parenthetical statement over here We're going to see in a second why all of this wasn't all that important. We're going to get to the important line in the last two lines of the daf of the Amud here. So it says there's a parenthetical remark here that triggers an enormous storm in the Rishonim, but it doesn't matter for us really, so we can happily kind of bypass it. It says the Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Incidentally, Rabbi Yochanan says Devar Torah Afilu Asay Lesbei. The reality is that as far as the Chumash goes, the guy actually could walk right into the Har HaBayis. No problem. It's only the Chazal blocked it. Like it says in the Pasuk in Divrei HaYamim. Divrei HaYamim is a fascinating sefer. If you've never read it, it gives you all kinds of stories that you don't have in Malachim, even though it's theoretically a recap. It says there was a time when Yehoshaphat HaMelech Yehuda was under threat. It was an enormous threat because you had a kind of a collaboration of a number of enemy armies who were all combining to attack Yehoshaphat, and he was a Melech Tzadik, this Yehoshaphat. And so it says here that they came and they essentially stormed the Mikdash in order to pray to Hashem to rescue them from this threat. And it was very successful, and Hashem said, agreed, you guys don't have to do anything, I'll take care of it on my own. So in any case, what happens was, Vayamod Yehoshaphat v'kal Yehuda lefnei Chatzer HaChadasha. Yehoshaphat leads the group into the Chatzer HaChadasha of the Mikdash. Maya Chatzer HaChadasha, what kind of an expression is that? The new yard, the new courtyard of the Mikdash. Rabbi Yochanan says, Shechid Shubat Dvarim v'yamru tvul yom lo yikanis l'machani l'viya. It was a new rule that blocked all the tvul yoms from coming into the Machan and to the Ezra's Nashim, like the Harabais. In any case, that has really nothing to do with us. The important thing is the next two lines, which is, and here's the relevant lines. The Amar Ula. Ula says the following, makes the following comment. He says, in the case of the Metzora guy, whose job is to become Tohor by standing there and sticking his thumb into the Mikdash in order to be able to have the Kohen inside put the blood of the Yashem onto his thumb and onto his toe, He's already, this is Ula's view. He is already violating an Iser Kares by doing so, by sticking his arm. Now remember, the Metzora had not yet brought his Karbanos. He's in the process of getting sprinkled the blood in order to be performing the Karbanos. But that necessitates his violation of the illegal encroachment on the space of the Azara in order to be part of get his Tahara process. So Ula says, Hoil v'hutar l'tzarato, since all Mitzorayim have to be doing that in order to be permitted to do their Tahara, and that's what the Chumash intends. That's part of the process. So once the Chumash is allowing this guy to violate the encroachment rule of going into the Mikdash, despite his Tumah status or his Mechus Kippurim status, hutar l'kiruyo. So that's why, even though this guy still has tvul yom from his carry, he's allowed to because, why? Because hoel v'ishtari ishtari. Because once the Chumash allows this guy for his purposes to be doing a thing that's the crime of whatever the crime is, and now there's a second layer of the same crime that applies to this person, well, the Chumash is going to presumably allow you to do it, that second crime also in the performance of the mitzvah. That's the issue of ishtari ishtari. So now the argument being that is the same model of what's going on with Yibum when I have a woman and a man whose relationship is incestuous on two counts. One being sister-in-law from the dead brother, and the other one is sister-in-law from the wife, or for that matter, any of the other 15 incestuous relationships that the Mishnah and Beis Amud Aleph list, such as the man's daughter, whatever. And so in all those cases, and here's the point is, I should use the argument, Hoel v'ishtari ishtari. And that actually sounds like it's a pretty good one, and we'll have to see on the next daf how we deal with this, but in the next daf, we're going to continue with these same kinds of analyses and drashos until I think finally, we wrap up the whole first sugya on Chesem Beis, so stay tuned next week. Okay, everybody.
Yashikach.